Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
Women give birth to everything great.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast where we bring you interviews with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 107, a talk with a true living legend, Murs. Nicholas Murs Carter is a rapper who has seen and done it all. He began his career in the Los Angeles underground scene as a teenager in the early 1990s with his friends in the Living Legends Collective, doing shows, recording, and making a name for himself by selling tapes hand-to-hand on street corners. He released a steady string of solo albums, starting with 1997's For Real, and developed a solid fan base. By the early years of the next decade, he had become a major player in the world of underground rap. His collaborations with Slug from Atmosphere, under the group name Felt, were critical and popular favorites, and he aligned himself with the powerful Def Jux label for his 2003 album, The End of the Beginning. But it was yet another collaboration that would cement Murs' reputation. He teamed with the producer Ninth Wonder in 2004 for the album Murs 316, The Ninth Edition, the first of five full-length projects the duo would do. Murs would go on to release more individual and collaborative records on both independent and major labels, and create and host the popular Paid Dues Festival. Recently, he signed to Tech N9ne's Strange Music label. His new album, out today, May 18th, is Have a Nice Life. We spoke to him in two different locations. First, while he was on tour in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and then, due to a spotty Skype connection, a few days later at his home in Arizona. If you enjoy The Cipher and want to see it continue, consider making a donation at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Every little bit helps, and we even have special rewards and experiences for our donors. Also, find The Cipher on iTunes. From there, you can rate, review, and subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. The more 5-star ratings we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get great guests. And now, here's the man who really means it when he tells you to have a nice life, Murs. Where are you now, by the way?
I'm in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Doing the whole strange music, you know, middle of the country thing.
Yes, yes, yes.
Nice. You know, you've been on a ton of different labels and stuff throughout your career, you know, starting independent, all that kind of thing. And I saw this one interview where you talked about it as possibly being, use the words, a permanent home. What is it about that label and like the people involved that makes you think that Strange could possibly be that?
I think it's more about me and where I'm at in my life and just wanting to settle down as far as my career goes. This shit could all go pear-shaped. You know, who knows what could happen. But it's just time for me to settle in somewhere. And I think Strange is as good as a label as any. But I genuinely do like everyone. Not to say that I didn't like everyone at Warner Brothers or Rhymesayers. I don't work with people I don't like. I was on a subsidiary of Warner, and I didn't really like those people when I went in and smashed up the office and grabbed a crowbar and went crazy.
Wow, taking it back to the 90s.
Yeah, that's the era I'm from. So I did that, and that's how I got upstream from that label to Warner Brothers. And so I'll bust up any label that I don't like, but I definitely don't work with people I don't like. So I don't like to badmouth where I've been by saying Strange is better than. It's just different, and it's a good fit for me at this point in my life. And wherever I went next was going to be the permanent home, and I considered multiple labels, and this just seemed to work out. So I'm happy to be here, and just at this point in my career, it's time for me to settle down and focus in one direction.
And you have a new record coming out with them, which is great, called Have a Nice Life. By the time people hear this, it'll be out. And one thing about it that I want to talk about, like both on a couple different songs on the album and in interviews, you've talked a lot about post-traumatic stress disorder. You even have a song called PTSD on the record.
Post-traumatic stress, PTSD. If you're from the hood, then you just like me. Niggas kicking your dough for a PS3. How the fuck you expect me to be stress-free? Homeboy asked me if I've been to the service. Standing on stage, taking flicks, got me nervous. All up in my face when I'm trying to be working. Sit your fat ass down behind that curtain. Bitch, I'm from the land of the Bloods and the Crips. Niggas kill niggas just to fuck a bitch. You could lose your life for that busted shit. By the time I was 9, I seen a bunch of shit. Lost my homies in the Iraq back.
Yes.
Yeah, and you talked about having it. I was very interested in that. My girlfriend and a few people she knows do film workshops all the time with vets with PTSD. So it's, you know, something I've had at least indirectly some experience with. And so I guess, like, when did you start realizing that, you know, being around violence and stuff as you were growing up had had that kind of effect on you?
I think I realized it when I moved from Los Angeles to Oakland, California, and I was one of my best friends, who Terry, who I mentioned off and on throughout my career. We were walking down the street, and it was just weird that we felt like we didn't have to watch out for the police, that we didn't have to watch out for rival gang members. And I was like, "Wow, we're from a fucked up place." Because we like, it almost feels fucked up that we don't have to watch out for people. But I didn't consider it PTSD or anything like that until I met a friend of my wife's recently, about 4 or 5 years ago, and he came back from the Middle East fighting. I think he was in the Army, he was a Ranger or something, and he couldn't get a job, and his wife was telling us that he sat around and just drank, used to smoke, but just drank and played Call of Duty all day. I said, "That's what my homies do that are out of prison and can't get a job and can't really function in normal, because they have, you know, they're active, former active gangbangers and people who have been a part of the penal system for so long that they just don't function. So all they do is drink and play Call of Duty." But this is a right wing, conservative, upper class white man that was served in the Army. And these, my friends, are like Crips who with felonies. But they were exhibiting some of the same extreme symptoms of post-traumatic stress, you know, and that's when I started realizing, like, you know, kind of with Afro Man, that's like an extreme case of what I was talking about.
In an incident that was caught on video, the Because I Got High rapper turned around during a guitar solo and punched a female fan who had jumped on stage to dance with him in the face. In a statement, Afro Man said, "This was a completely involuntary reflex reaction to people infringing on my stage space. It was uncharacteristic behavior that was initiated by outside uncontrolled forces." He also went on to say there was a lack of security. He has since apologized and said, "I need some help. I'm going to find a foundation. I didn't have time to medicate. It was an early show."
But I don't allow people that I don't know to be on stage or be in my periphery when I'm rapping, because I am liable to hit them. Or, you know, my wife recently came up behind me in the studio and I like threw the headphones at her and like swung at her, and, you know, I was able to divert the punch. But I always tell her, like, you have to knock. You can't just come up behind me. You can't just grab me from the back or anything like that, because I've been living on the edge for 30 some odd years in a war zone. You know, when you compare the statistics of Desert Storm to how many people died in just in the city of Los Angeles, they dwarf those numbers as far as fatalities.
What kind of response have you had since you started speaking out about that? I noticed in a few interviews, at least, you've been starting to make these kind of comparisons.
It's early yet, so I haven't really got any feedback yet. But I want people to know, and especially in the urban communities and the Black and brown communities, that it's okay to maybe start seeking help, because you should be treated as a veteran. I don't feel there's enough care out there for our veterans, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you say that about getting treatment, because, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you know, you had that writer's blues where you say, you know, they say I need a shrink, but I'm going to stick to my pen and my pad.
They say I need a shrink, but I think I'm going to stick to my pen and my pad. My only therapist, my life, and I'm sharing it with y'all.
hoping it can stop you from tearing down the walls, cause I'm going through it too. Expose it in our tracks and I'm showing it to you so we can break it down and benefit. Analyze the minute shit, skip the cigarette.
What made you change your mind about that?
I had somewhat of a nervous breakdown, extreme panic attack, and ended up in the hospital, and they couldn't find out what was wrong with me, and I was back and forth to the ER, and then finally they told me I suffered from anxiety and depression, and they started putting me on pills, and I went on tour with Slug shortly after Varsity Blues. That's when it all happened, and the shrink, I told the shrink what I did for a living. And he said, okay, we've refilled my prescription. And when I called from the road to refill my prescription, he told me I had to come in. And I said, motherfucker, I told you I'm on a 70-day tour. There's no way.
Right.
And he said, oh, I didn't know. Well, I was like, fuck you. So I was smart enough, because he warned me about going cold turkey off the meds. So I was smart enough to like call him a few days out. And so I started taking half a pill, half a pill, half a pill, till I ran out. And we got to Montreal, and I got dope sick. Couldn't get out of the bed. I just started having withdrawal. And so I suffered through that. And when I got back home, I was like, there's no fucking way that I'm ever going back on meds. So I had to do group therapy, which I dreaded. And I had to do personal therapy and workshops and these worksheets. And it's CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked through that and took off the road for 3 months and did the 12-week group therapy and did some personal sessions. Changed my diet, started exercising more, and so far, so good.
That makes a lot of sense. One of the things that has been a constant theme in your catalog, it's a big theme on Varsity Blues and a big theme on the new record, especially on the closing track, I Miss Mikey, is death.
I miss Mikey because that's the way it is. You start to lose your friends and you don't want to live. You gotta give it time and the pain will pass. I miss Walker and Kamu and the homie Pooh. Days pass and days to come. You gotta live your life and make each day your favorite one. In the days,
you know, death of people around you, the inevitability of your own death. I mean, for someone who, you know, maybe has a rep as kind of like, oh, I make lighthearted songs about girls, that's a pretty heavy topic you come to a lot.
Yeah, man. As I said in the I Miss Mikey song, it's just something that me and my brother, and I feel like our generation, and even more so than my generation, my wife, some of my best friends that I've met and people that I've met outside of my city, usually their parent or their grandparent is the first person they know that dies. And I you know, from I guess I don't even know when I was, when our first friend died, probably 13, 14, I've been going to funerals. And it's been just something that's been, not even just from gang violence, but just my stepfather, my father. So it's just something that I feel really qualified to speak on. And not so much in a, I try not to put it in such a negative light. It's, you know, it's inevitable. And in a life that's full of uncertainties, it's nice to have one guarantee. So there's some type of solace to be found in that.
I mean, I remember seeing an interview with you where you said at least some of the reason you even had a wedding was so that your friends could dress up in nice clothes, not for a funeral or a sentencing, which is a pretty, you know, stark thing to say.
Yeah, because nobody from where I'm from gets married. You know, there's two of us out of probably 15, 20 of us that, you know, I consider our hood or our family. The only time I literally, you know, I have a suit, first suit I bought was because of, first suit I wore anywhere, I said because of a funeral, like as an adult. I was kind of tired of it.
Yeah. And I Miss Mikey, is the Mikey of the title, is that idea?
Yeah, definitely.
Mikey here is, of course, Michael Idea Larson, a freestyle battle champion, lyricist, and musician from St. Paul, Minnesota. He won several notable battle competitions, including a victory at Scribble Jam in
1999.
Regular listeners will note that we talked to Sage Francis about Scribble Jam in episode 81, as well as Tanya Morgan in episode 94. In 2001, Idea, along with his friend DJ Abilities, released their first record, Firstborn. In 2002, he released a solo record under the pseudonym Oliver Hart, appropriately titled The Many Faces of Oliver Hart.
Yo, y'all might think he's a cool cat, but he's still reacting weird.
Why they always looking at me like this?
my face, man. No matter where I go, I'm always feeling out of place. And I know I'm not your regular, I got a different taste. Probably cause most of my life's been right in my basement. I didn't watch a Super Bowl, don't drink alcohol. Don't carry ID, don't go to the mall. I'm extra argumentative and really good at basketball. I can't dance or sing, but I can rap my ass off. Hey, my voice is unique, I'll leave it at that. But no rapper you know has the ideas I have. And it ain't like the skin.
He continued on working with Abilities, and they put out records in 2004 and 2009, all on Slug's influential Rhymesayers Entertainment label. A label Murs also released projects with. In fact, Idea was even a member of the supergroup The Orphanage, which included Slug, Aesop Rock, Sage Francis, Illogic, and upcoming Cypher guest Blueprint.
Shut the fuck up and die is what I really want to say to you. Hope someone hits you in your face till it's 80 different shades of blue. Isn't there anything better you got to do than jock my crew? I sever contenders and render the healing process impossible. You talk trash behind my back trying to act like you know me. But when you see me at the show, you give me that like we're homies. Remember bad day?
Idea died in October of 2010, something we also touch on with Sage Francis. His death was ruled an accident and was blamed on opiate toxicity.
Wow. What was your relationship like with him?
Ah, man. I want to say like a little brother. He loved to tell the story. The first time I met him, like he was the youngest in the Rhymesayers camp and the freestyle battle guy that they relied on for that aspect. And I was sort of the same way coming into Living Legends. I was about 3 or 4 years older than him. So when I first met Rhymesayers, my first time in Minneapolis, we're opening for Hyro at First Ave. And I remember meeting Slug, who was selling his tape there. And I don't remember meeting Idea. And he came up to me and he said, hey, because I put out a song called Sunspray with the Three Melancholy Gypsies. And we were all like 14, 15 on that song. And that was kind of the story as the tape traveled around the world. And I guess Idea had heard it and heard how young we were. And so he came up to me, he's like, hey, man, you're Murs. I was 15 too. And he said, I just looked at him like, what the fuck? He was like, it's a stupid thing to say, but you were a dick. I was like, well, what was I supposed to say? And he was the first person from Rhymesayers to invite me to his home and do a song with me, which he later erased. The first white person I saw treat their dog like a human being and share peanut butter off the same spoon. I don't know, man. It's so much, you know, I've seen, like, I would say we are, and a lot of people become like brothers. I feel like sometimes going on tour is like going to war, but it's more like going on like one of those fishing shows, especially indie rap, because you have some days where you're performing in Oklahoma City and there's 30 people, and then you have some nights you're in Austin, Texas, and there's, you know, you caught a lot of fish, so to speak. But after that, it builds this camaraderie. So I've done a couple tours with him. And we just, and that was like my brother.
Oh, let me tell you about Idea. Your butt, you're soft. You like my beard, you're about to get cut off. Your scribble gem, thinking nothing to me. I mean, what you really want to say? Why you trying to front on me? I'm gonna break you down like you did your hand. You broke your jacket off at a high speed. Your DJ sucks, he's a one-man band that plays my song. You're dead wrong, you can never get me, you get gonged. Every time you go on freestyle, you won't last long. First, guaranteed winner, you're not that strong, kid. You're puny, look at you, your Adam's apple poking out. You better watch out from the west where we loking out. Don't be making jokes about what I do. You need to calm down, I'll serve the rest of your crew. Ass slug, you know I get felt. Everybody on the microphone, touch me, get smelt. What? Your whole wax style get crushed. Every time I hear your rhyme, it's so damn butt. You so close to my face, man, you need a toothbrush. What? I'ma tell you your rap style sucks. The dopest thing about the Legends Tour is us opening up.
But the song hit me like that is because one morning I was at my mom's house and I woke up in the morning and I was just bawling, like crying, like I haven't cried since my stepfather died when I was 14. And I was just like, I miss Mikey so much. And it's not somebody I talk to every day, but just someone that whose presence and energy was so big that that light being gone, I could just feel it subconsciously. I miss him more than I've missed any of my friends, some that I grew up with every day. It was my only way to speak on it.
And you know, niggas are smoking and drinking and you're all feeling the same pain. And we come from a culture where it's not all the way legit to share your feelings. So we don't even know how, some of us don't even know how to connect on that level, you know?
I miss Mikey cuz That's the way it is. You start to lose friends, and you don't want to live. You gotta give it.
And I didn't want to. The song's not necessarily about him, it's about death. But he's someone that I miss dearly. I guess my relationship to him was like a brother. You know, I when I had my sons, the first thing we got to Minneapolis, I wanted them to meet his mother because Kathy is such a great person and she's always been so kind to me. And she's probably the best rap mom there ever was. She showed up on our bus when we first met her with condoms, beanies, and gloves for everybody on the bus. She's just a phenomenal woman. And I wanted my children just to be able to touch her, because to me, she basically raised Idea and Abilities in her house. So she's a dynamic mother, and hopefully she'll always be a part of my life. You know, we don't talk every day. We talk once, twice a year, maybe. But him and his family will always be, hold a special place in my heart.
And you were talking about how the first time he heard you was on Sunsprayed.
Oh, still playing.
Approach my mental dimension with physical apprehension. Feel the tension building, or is it your fate just sealing you in? Should I begin to interfere? Chop off an ear for your listening pleasure, because I'm displaying them styles beyond measure. Yeah, every second of life should be treasured, because you never know when it could be your last. You never know when I could blast with my telekinetic ability. I rhyme when it has agility. You booty MCs are killing me with laughter.
Which was that was 3MG, right?
Yeah.
That was the name of the group?
Yes, sir.
How'd that group come together?
By a girl, like all great things, women give birth to everything great. There was a girl in class, and I thought she was cute, just weird looking. She had on a bright yellow jacket, and she got sent out of class, and I was never in class. So I started talking to her, and I always used to walk around a Source magazine in my back pocket, so she asked to borrow my magazine. I was like, "What do you know about hip-hop?" And she said, "I love Freestyle Fellowship." And I was like, "Well, I have the promo of their new album." She's like, "What? You have the whole album?" And this is back when you had I was like interning at a very young age and plugged into getting, like, you know, albums 3 months before they came out, like the press copies. So I gave her a copy of Inner City Griots, and we became friends, and her boyfriend was in a group with Eli and Scarab, and I became a fan of them, and then I became their DJ, and then the same girl caused a rift in their group, and I ended up taking her boyfriend's place in the group with Eli and Scarab, kind of.
You can see videos for some of that stuff. It's super funny to see you in high school. I think in the video, you're literally wearing a backpack.
Yeah, I'm wearing a backpack and a Loud Records t-shirt. And we recorded it at Mike Caron's house, who I believe now is the president of Atlantic Records.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, you know, from there, you know, you sort of came together with the Living Legends crew. A lot of the early stuff you did with them, your verses are kind of concerned with respect, right? You weren't getting the attention you deserved from the Source or from fans or from sound people at local venues, you know, so one of which I think you even mentioned by name.
And never forget, gets ready to come on. The sound goes wrong, it starts buzzing. Was it just him, or was it that he had a vendetta against the underground? Man, I really don't know, but I will never do another show at Cat's Alley. About to lead a rally to protest all these whack MCs in the way that I manifest. Freestyle's better than your written. Your whole style was bitten after I'm ripping your
shit. What was your state of mind at the time you were first doing that batch of Living Legend stuff?
Yeah, I was angry kid that was called ugly and picked on. Even within Living Legends, I was called ugly, and I wasn't seen as the dopest rapper, so I was fighting for my respect within that circle. Yeah, just, you know, like most young black males, angry at my father, angry at society. Yeah, man, I think that's just where it came from. It was just, and most teenagers are angry. I went to see my wife and I went to a wedding therapist, and a wedding therapist, marriage therapist, same thing. He said, "Oh, what do you do?" I said, "I rap." And he said, "Oh, I'm from Coney Island. Like, I am hip." He's like 50. He's like, "I am hip hop. Like, we used to," I never knew this, but he said, "I used to soak my shoestrings in water overnight and then stretch them out and iron them to make fat laces." And I was like, "Wow." He's like, "You know, Sugar Hill Gang was my prom music. Like, I'm a real B-boy. Like, I wrote graffiti. Like, I'm the, he's like, "I don't have a problem with new rap." Because I put it in perspective, he's like, "When I was younger, Melly Mel was in his 20s when he did The Message. Now you guys start rapping at, you know, Chuck D was 20-something when he did It Takes a Nation of Millions. He had been in college, he had experienced some shit. But when you're, you know, 16, 17, 14, 15, you get a microphone, of course you're going to say, 'Suck my dick, fuck you, I'm going to fuck you up,' because that's all you know." It's kind of like Eddie Murphy when he's talking about in Raw, how, like, when he first started, all he had was dick and fart jokes.
My mother would sit there and watch her little 15-year-old son on stage saying some outlandish shit. My whole act back then was about taking a shit, because that's all I had done at 15. That was my life experience, but it sounded like Richard Pryor jokes. I'd be going, you ever like sometime, right, you get on that toilet, and when you shit, that water splash up on your ass?
Because that's all you know. Unfortunately, you know, for rap, it's not okay to have a ghostwriter. Like Smokey Robinson wrote for the Jackson 5, or Diana Ross wrote for the, you know, whoever wrote for the younger groups, because you didn't have shit to say. You hadn't been through shit. You don't know a fucking thing. But rap is full of young motherfuckers with all this teen angst and anger. And that was me. I probably shouldn't have been writing my own lyrics. I didn't have shit to say. And most of the young people, so when people ask me about Mac Miller, or used to ask me about Mac Miller or Tyler, I'm like, what do you expect? You know?
Yeah, 20-something with the world at their feet, more or less, you know?
Yeah. But you know, I think that it's probably, that's why when people ask me about this new album, I feel like I'm finally qualified to really make just great American music, or just great music in general, because I've been married, you know, and sometimes almost divorced. I've been a father. I've buried a couple of my parents. Like, I have some shit to say. Most of these young motherfuckers don't have shit to say. So when people ask me like what I think of new artists, I always just say it's cool, but it's just not for me, because there's no pain, there's no experience in what they're saying, there's no wisdom in it.
Yeah. So one of the things about the new record, you know, that shows that kind of like subtlety and experience that comes with time is Anyways, right? The hook of it has this pretty common justification you hear in, you know, movies and records, and probably from a lot of actual people, about dealing drugs. You know, if I didn't sell it to them, they're gonna get it anyway. Flying birds up the interstate, iced out medallion about the size of a dinner plate. If I don't sell it to them, they gon' get it anyway. Gon' get it anyway. They gon' get it anyway. But the verses kind of complicate that stance by showing, you know, the actual effects of, in this example, crack cocaine on the lives of the users, the lives of the people around them. Square as a box, I stay in my lane. My daddy left my family cause of rock cocaine. Mom's working hard for us to maintain. If you didn't live it, it's hard to explain. From the outside, it looks insane. Once you touch that hard white, it's hard to make a change. We hoop the cop cool. I guess I just wanted you to talk about like writing a song that is in message anti-drug without like coming off as preachy, without coming out as like Nancy Reagan Part 2 or whatever.
Nancy Reagan Part 2. Sounds like a killer Mike song. Yeah, man, I've learned to submit to the music, and my friend Jesse made the beat, and it sounded like I could do a good hook, and I always definitely wanted to say Ice Down Medallion in a song. Shout out to Royal Flush, or Royal Fam, whatever one of them had that song, Ice Down Medallion. But I always also wanted to do a song, because sometimes in this middle of, like I said, doing a show in Oklahoma City for 30 people, I think, man, I could really be at home running the neighborhood business, so to speak, because I'm smart enough. Like someone like Kenneth McGriff, who was called AK Supreme, that supposedly was very low key with this shit. I always saw myself being someone like that.
Kenneth Supreme McGriff is a convicted American drug trafficker and organized crime figure. McGriff came to prominence in the early 1980s when he formed his own crack distributing organization, which he called the Supreme Team, based in the South Jamaica section of Queens, New York. Under McGriff's leadership, the gang's numbers swelled to the hundreds and came to control the crack cocaine trade in the Baisley Park houses, the neighborhood where McGriff was raised. McGriff arranged an elaborate security system around the projects, assigning lookouts equipped with walkie-talkies to keep watch from the tops of nearby buildings. If police officials entered the area, McGriff's security team would alert their dealers, who would then hide incriminating evidence. Neighborhood kids who were loyal to McGriff would be given special treats, including basketball tournaments and musical performances. McGriff is alleged to have had a hand in the 2002 murder of Run DMC member Jam Master Jay, and was convicted of ordering the 2001 killing of Mobb Deep affiliate E Moneybags. Federal authorities also accused him in connection with the attempted murder of 50 Cent. Persistent rumors suggest that McGriff felt 50 Cent had exposed too much of the drug kingpin in Jamaica, Queens, and others involved in the drug trade through the lyrics of the song Ghetto Koran, released in 2000. On February 1st, 2007, McGriff was convicted of murder for hire and sentenced to life in prison.
And being able to run and operate a drug business, because I'm definitely smarter than most 98% of the LAPD, and 98% of the people that grew up in my neighborhood. And I don't have the desire to stunt or shine. And I feel like I could have definitely transitioned my money into a couple businesses and by now and made a lot more money selling drugs. And for me also not having to go through the culture shock that I went through, performing for white people and traveling with white people, like atmosphere, and that shit bugs me out. And the conflicts I have with some of my peers, because me and Slug eventually had to come up with the term cultural differences, because we would just push each other's buttons and unintentionally, but where he grew up and where I grew up, it'd be, you know, it was, what I was doing was perfectly acceptable, but I can't behave like I'm hanging out in the inner city when I'm with Aesop Rock, because he doesn't get it, you know? It's not okay. There's a rapper I was on tour with, I won't say his name, but, you know, really close. Like I said, you develop this brotherhood, and his girlfriend was there, and I said something about her titties on stage, and he was like, yo, man, like got in my face about the shit, and I was like, really? Over a bitch? Like, are you serious? Like, we don't do that. And then that pushed it even further. And he's, you know, and this is a you know, passive aggressive, non-confrontational white dude, you know? Like, he's not trying to be tough. He's not from the hood, but he was really ready to fight me over this shit. And I was like, man. And he was older and a little bit more level-headed to say, you know what? It's just cultural differences. I was like, yeah, man, because someone that I feel as close to as I'm close to you, we would never, I'd call bitch a bitch. Is, you know, if it's not your wife, it's a bitch, you know? That's just how I grew up.
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to move in there was, like, your relationship with your audience during that period, during, like, around the, you know, 03, 04 kind of Def Jux period. Because you wrote about that on And This Is Four on MERS 316.
I feel I should have the scans white rappers have. It's sad, but that's the way it is. What's the reason that my album doesn't sell like his? And don't front like you don't know why the hell that is. It's because he's white. You can relate to his face. Through the years you've been taught that black is unsafe. Plus it's only natural for your own to be embraced. Conscious or subconscious, you can't say that ain't the case. Only reason it took so long to take place was up until now your only choice was third base. For others like Ice, wasn't really that tight. Now you got some white dudes who can truly rock the mic. You relate to their stories cause you share that past. Question is, why would you listen to Mercer's black ass?
Yeah.
For people who haven't heard the song or haven't heard the song in a while, can you kind of sum up what you were trying to get at with that tune?
Yeah, I feel like it's just, I've always been, and maybe still to this day, have been overly optimistic about the issue of race. Not as optimistic as my compatriot, I don't know what to call them, common. I don't think that racism will be solved by people extending a loving hand in the opposite direction, race-wise.
Now it's like, hey, we all know it's been some bad history in our country. We know that racism exists. I'm like saying, hey, y'all, I'm extending a hand, and I'm hoping a lot of the generations in different cultures are saying, hey, we want to get past this. Mm-hmm. If we've been bullied, we've been beat down, but we don't want it anymore. And we're not extending a fist. We're not saying, hey, you did us wrong. It's more like, hey, I'm extending my hand in love. Let's forget about the past as much as we can.
Right.
And let's move from where we are now. How can we help each other? Can you try to help us? Because we're going to help ourselves, too. That's really where we are right now.
How? And I think that's exactly right.
But I have been, and I remember being younger, and telling my mom, like, you know, that's your generation, because we moved from Linwood, which is next to Compton, Watts area, to a suburban white neighborhood. And, you know, I have experienced some trouble first, you know, neo-Nazis and shit like that, and cultural differences there, because I was fighting a lot. And they, where I grew up, you fight somebody and your friends, you know, 10 minutes after. There it was like a lifelong, it was, you know, oh my God, you got physical. You're just a low life scumbag. Anyway, my mom used to always tell me, like, there'll always be differences between black and white people, and don't think these white boys are your friends. And I like, you know, you don't know. And then eventually they would all prove her right. We moved back to LA, and even the guy who produced this album, Jesse, we had some interactions. And my mom would be like, watch out, you know? And my friend Eli, and I've had white friends since I moved to the Valley. I've always had a few white friends since then. And she was like, you know, she would warn me, and I'm like, it's different. You know, your generation is dying. Things are different. You know, it's a new world. And inevitably, she was always proved right. And before I met Slug, I had kind of gone deeper. I kind of disassociated myself with Living Legends, and I was just hanging out in my neighborhood on Cloverdale with a bunch of random Crips and just regular niggas, for lack of a better term. And I, you know, when I go out to hip hop stuff, I'd go out and then I just come right back. I would go out to sell tapes, but I wouldn't hang out too much because I felt like these are the people who really understand me. We may not have the same interest. We may not be intellectually on the same page, but our ethics and our code are the same, and I can deal with that. I can't deal with these other people. And then people around me started getting shot and going to jail. And simultaneously, I started having more opportunities to tour abroad and nationwide with Sean and LP and Aesop. So I started doing that. And I think me and Sean did about a year and a half, 2 years together, where I did Warped Tour and a United States tour with them. Then I did a tour with Aesop, then I did a tour with LP. And I was touring for all these white kids, and it was weird, but it was good because I was making money and shit was going crazy back home. So I was happy. And then when I said, okay, at the end of this, Atmosphere's booking agent picked me up and decided to book a solo tour for me. And LP decided to put out my record. And some of the same venues, I remember doing Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I had just done it about 6 to 8 months before with Atmosphere, and it was sold out, you know, let's say 1,800 people. And we had done the Felt record together. So everyone who knew who he was knew who I was. Like, I felt very confident in that. And they had seen me do a lot of great live performance. And when I came back, there was maybe 180 people in the same venue. And I had been touring New Mexico. There was a shop called LA Underground there. I had been touring New Mexico way before Atmosphere. So I felt like at least those people should have come. I had done bigger shows without him before I met him. And so now it should just be growing, right? And at the end of the night, the promoter came up to me and was like, yo, you know, he was a cool dude. We had built a rapport. His name is Thomas. Thomas is a good dude. Thomas is like, yo, just to be honest, we went on sale today with Atmosphere tickets, and they sold more tickets for the show coming up in 2 months than you sold tickets tonight.
Wow. And that's where the song came from.
Yeah. And I didn't want to express it as an angry song. I don't, you know, but, you know, what came to my mother was she never hated white people, but it's just, it's natural for people to gravitate towards their own kind, so to speak. You know, and Sean has spoke on it, and he's the only one of my white rapper friends that will own it. You know, he's like, you know, in Herb magazine where Atmosphere on the cover, he's like, there's no reason that Jean Grey and Merce shouldn't be selling as many records as I do. But the white intellectual crowd that listens to Atmosphere only want to hear black people if it's the Dipset or if it's what they're comfortable with. If they want to hear black people do so-called white hip hop, they'll just listen to a white rapper do it. And overall, that's how the audience reacts. You know, and even I feel the same thing goes for a lot of Latino kids. There's, you know, if I do a show at House of Blues, I'll sell 1,000 tickets. Sean, who's not from LA, did 2 nights at the Palladium, 7,000 tickets sold. And he invited me to come out and do Dirty Girl during his set. And people go batshit, like, fucking Jesus showed up when we do Felt songs. And I'm like, well, where are the rest of you 6,000 motherfuckers when I have a show?
Right.
Without Sean.
Right.
But no one's comfortable. it's just a stigma. You know, if you're black, you have to be validated by the black community. And there's a certain type of non-black person that likes black music. And the white kids that are into Jeezy will listen to a Jeezy or Kendrick Lamar and don't fuck with Atmosphere or Merce. But the white kids who listen to Atmosphere won't fuck with Jeezy and they won't fuck with Merce. But they'll fuck with A$AP Rock and they'll fuck with me when I fuck with one of them. But they won't fuck with me on my own. And black people won't fuck with me because they see me fuck the, like, the OK Player kids don't fuck with me because they see me fuck with Atmosphere. It's just, it's crazy.
Yeah.
But there's never been a black artist to succeed without gaining the acceptance of the black community. And it used to be there wasn't a white artist that succeeded in hip hop without the validation of the black community, thus Eminem needing Dr. Dre. But I think Macklemore's finally broke that mold.
At this point, our Skype connection totally shit the bed. So we finished our conversation with Merz via phone. What I was saying before we dropped off was I was curious how people took And This Is For. You laid out pretty clearly why you wrote it, but did people get defensive? How was that song received?
Some people were like, yeah, even though you don't want white people listening, I still like you, or even though you hate white people. And I was like, that wasn't the point at all. But overall, I think it was received in the right manner, but there are people who misinterpret it.
Yeah, and there was one thing you actually did get mean about a few years prior in a song literally called Mole Men and Merz Get Mean.
I say too much, but these rap ass niggas do it way too much. I'm always into some shit, they say I play too much, but this shit ain't a game, these lanes have bit our shit. They wasn't screaming independent before 1996, they was shopping a demo on a label, got dropped, then they came back screaming underground hip hop, and I'm supposed to accept it. That's why you never see them featured artists on my record. They make good music, so I gotta respect it, but those two words are as close as we get to being cool and connected. I'm calm and collected to
You criticize rappers who get a label deal, get dropped, then all of a sudden they're claiming underground.
Yeah.
Did that happen a lot back in those days?
Yeah, I mean, well, that was the prime example was Hieroglyphics or that. You know, now it's funny how history is, but, you know, now most kids will assume they've been independent their whole career. You know, Dilated, it happened to, who else, I forget, probably more recently. But I mean, it probably started with Rockets, but I don't even consider that real independent because, you know, it's pressing up your life, you know, still somewhat of a machine. Definitely was happening back then.
Can you talk more about the change in the underground? Because around 2003 on You and I and some other places, you were talking about how it was becoming just like the so-called mainstream, another part of the normal record industry.
Give a fuck if you dub this shit. No. Now the industry is running this underground shit. What? The industry is running this underground shit. Oh. Now what that means is my crew wants a street team. My crew wants a video so they could be seen. And that was my dream since I was 13. But as I got older and the world got colder, reality swooped and pushed dreams over. Now I'm content with the mastery of word. Realize the important thing is just being heard by fans who love you and you love them. And honestly, it's love that moves this thing. It's about me.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, being Deck Jack was different than being on Warner Brothers is just understaffed and, you know, a lot less funding. But the thing was the same. Like, and I don't know, you know, I didn't know till later, but, you know, I didn't know that, you know, a lot of the independent guys did the same thing, E-40 or Master P. But, you know, I had a publicist telling me what I should say, who I should and should talk to. You know, marketing plans and things like that. And that was, you know, that wasn't very underground or punk rock to me. And everybody, you know, that some of my friends, as we'd be, you know, things I didn't care about, but I do them because, you know, it's necessary to sell records. I saw my friends becoming jealous of me for getting those things or chasing those things. That we didn't chase before, but as soon as we got the opportunity, it began to chase more fame. And you know, ironically, I ended up being the one to get more of the press and more of the accolades, but I didn't want it, nor did I want to chase it. I wanted to sell more records, and I wanted to be more popular musically, but all the other stuff that came with it that my friends seemed to want so bad, I ended up getting, and they ended up not getting.
And you ended up for a brief spell for one record on Warner Brothers. You laid out how a little earlier in the interview. One thing about that album that was crazy to me is you actually managed to clear a Michael Jackson sample on Can It Be.
For my supporters and my fans, man, I know y'all been waiting. Now it's finally here, and thank you for your patience. The world's gone crazy since we last spoke. Bloodshed and war, the absence of hope. Shooting at the school, economy's a joke. Homies on heroin, homies on coke. But can you even blame them when they only trying to coke? Damn.
It was just as simple as getting it done. I did the song and they liked it, and the president of Warner Brothers' son, Ryan Wally, at the time was my other, I had two A&Rs, he was one of my A&Rs, and he suggested I work with Scoop DeVille, or I don't know how it, I wanted to remake La Raza.
Some of you don't know what's happening, que pasa, it's not for you anyway, because this is for La Raza.
And I was told I couldn't, but they said, you can work with Kid Frost's son on a beat. And I was like, cool. And it wasn't, he hadn't had a really big record yet. But he was working with Snoop, who was, I had the same management at the same time. And so he's working with Snoop. And so he worked with me and Snoop on the record. On our individual, Snoop was doing Ego Trip and I was doing March for President. He had beats on both of those, I believe. And those are his first, I think, real big looks. Scoop made that beat. I did the song. There was no hook to it, but Ryan liked it, and so Ryan pushed it through. And the funny thing is, I think with Motown and it's not the Beatles for the most part. People who own publishing want to make money. They want to let you use it. When you get to some of these soul singers that are just bitter and just, I think, angry humans, is where it gets hard to clear things. You know, J. Cole references on his shit. Like, I want to pay you, I want to use it, you're just being a dick.
And all the motherfucking samples that clear, thank you. Y'all be trying to give a nigga a hard time on the samples, man. I'ma go to the fucking Supreme Court and try to make this shit easier for niggas like me to clear these samples, man. If you made the fucking music and you made the art and you put it into the world, I should be able to use it however the fuck I want. I'ma pay you, I'ma give you a percentage, but you shouldn't be able to tell me I can't use it. That's fucked up, nigga. You was inspired by the world, allow the world to be inspired by your shit and to use your shit. So all them people like George McCulloch,
you know?
Yeah.
And it's not what it's not some of the more prestigious artists. Those are some of the easiest to clear because it's just business. If you have the budget, cool. They'll do it. And if you're willing to give up a lot of publishing, you know, I had a harder time clearing. I used to Lovers and I had clearing Michael Jackson. They were Ohio Players. I thought that would be hard as hell. They worked with me. They gave me a decent price. They understood I was an independent artist. It really is on the individual or the individual that owns it. But if the artist doesn't own the publishing, it's usually not a problem if you have the money. Because the person who bought the rights to it wants to make money. It's usually when the artists still have the rights to it and they're bitter about something or they're angry at rappers.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. So on that record, you know, you had Snoop as a guest. Pulling on some of that, sipping on some yak stars with the Mars, splurge with Mars, blank out, make out, stay way up, cause it's about to go down for real. You had Will I Am as a guest. Yeah, I'm about to spread my wings, I'm looking fly. Watch a nigga spread his wings, I'm looking fly. And that kind of leads to one other thing I wanted to talk about, which is like literally from your very first album and on the second one as well, you defend like mainstream rappers that a lot of the underground at that time would kind of talk shit about. Like, you defend Puffy on the end of your first record, basically saying like, okay, well, if people are listening to him in the ghetto, that's hip hop, and it doesn't matter whether you think it is or not.
All you motherfuckers from outside looking in,
saying this is hip hop and this is not hip hop. Motherfucking hip hop is what's being bumped in the ghetto. So if they bumping Puffy in the ghetto, who the fuck is you to say that's not hip hop? Whatever's being heard there, where it started, is what hip hop is. Stop trying to define something you don't know shit about.
And then on the next record, you're defending Master P.
Now all you conscious rappers really need to check yourselves. Disrespecting other artists just to gain respect yourselves. With Master P, probably done more for the community than your ass will ever do. Wrapped in your self-righteous cypher so your ass never knew. A lot of these thugs is actually better than you. So nigga, raise your...
Neither of these were really common stances for underground rappers to take in like 1998. Because so much of underground rap at that time was set up in like explicit opposition to Bad Boy. Did you ever kind of take any grief from your peers for that?
No, I think a lot of, they know that they're out of place. I feel like if they're going to argue with me, or they know that I'm right, or they're just, or they just feel that they're right and they don't want to argue. But, I never got any real grief on the underground. Or you don't get grief in this industry, really, from any rappers. And I wouldn't allow it. I guess maybe either they know that or not. But, most rappers and most men are cowards when it comes down to it. They may say things and whisper in somewhere in the background, but no one's going to give me any grief or debate much of shit with you. Because either they're too rich and or too successful to be worried and happy to be worried about the fuck you have to say, or they're too scared or they agree. Those are the three categories.
Yeah. And, one thing I was curious about was like back in 99, you said a dope MC consists of talent, content, charisma, and delivery.
Whack is the lesson. A dope MC consists of talent, content, charisma, and delivery. Remember it, write it down, take a picture. I don't give a fuck whatever it takes to commit it to memory. Because your half-assed assembly of subject and predicate is killing me.
And all these years later, would you change those categories at all? And where do you think you as an artist stand in all of them?
I definitely wouldn't. I wouldn't change that. Because there's Gucci, and I think that he's real heavy on charisma and not so much on content.
Because it is a lemma. And my life is Georgia peaches, but you look more like a lemma. And my sour apple bitter bitches, I'm not fucking with them. I'm truly stupid paid, that's just how I feel today. I'm moving slow cause coding cereals in my lemonade. I'm standing in the shade.
And he has a different delivery, he has a very unique delivery. And he's extremely creative. Maybe insanity, but insane, but he's creative. He's eccentric. He's deep in a lot of those areas, so his content lacks a little bit. But also his content is very authentic. It may not be technically the deepest thing that'll change his life, but it is truly his experience and is what he's living as, as you can see with his Joe record.
Yeah. So where do you think where would you rate yourself in those categories? Talent, content, charisma, and delivery.
I feel my only shortcoming may be in I don't know if I'm. Some people are just reeking talent. I think I work very hard at what I do. It's not effortless. But I think I have all of it. For me, I couldn't really rate myself. I can't be objective.
Sure.
But I definitely have enough to get by any of the categories to be relevant or considered dope or a real MC.
Yeah. And so this new album, you've mentioned Jesse a few times, who produced most of it. It's Jesse, how do you pronounce his last name? Shatkin, is that right?
Shatkin, yeah.
So he's best known now, to the extent he's known, for engineering and now producing stuff for pop artists, Kelly Clarkson, Katy Perry, Pink, and stuff like that. But you go way back with him, right?
Yeah. Since we were 15, he produced God's Work for me.
I got a whole stacking, was snapped out of my daydream by something that I seen. I left the tissue full of spunk on the floor by my jeans. It seems I have.
He produced Brother We Love on that.
It's dedicated to all my little brothers, little homies. Go check it out.
Man, you
21 now and I still can't believe it. Been living on your own, just hard to conceive that you on the right track out pursuing that knowledge. But a few years back, I couldn't see you in college. You was all
Daddy did a lot of work with Cannibal Ox, did a lot of work with C-Rays. So, like, you know, definitely in the under in the indie New York scene, funny enough, he was very important and relevant. And, you know, me and Eli and Scarab used to hit his house up all the time in West L.A. He was one of the first people, my first friend with the four-track recorder. So we would record vocals at his house all the time. And we had a DJ crew. We would DJ together. So, yeah, we've been down since, I guess that's 93.
Wow.
93, shit.
And then as he got into the pop world, did you ever kind of have an eye at that point, like, oh, well, I'm definitely going to bring him back for something?
Oh, hell no. We reunited musically via Kosha Deal. We'd see each other and check in. Like, when he got his new house, I just came by to check it out in L.A., I think. And, but musically, we checked back in because I was putting on Kosha Deal's record, and he produced the whole thing. And I came over to lay vocals for Kosha. And we just said, let's work. And I said, you know, I thought he was just engineering. I didn't know he was producing pop records. And we had done some remixes, but I figured, oh, they just wanted a hip-hop remix, so they let him do something. But I genuinely loved what he was doing for Kosha. And I thought, you know, he knows, and he's been critical, I think, of my delivery since the beginning. And originally I wanted he and our other friend Ariel, God forgive me if I can't pronounce his name, but he's produced for is it Haim or Haim? Haim?
I think so, yeah.
And Snoop, Major Lazer, I think he's doing a new Brandon Flowers record. Like, he's huge, Brandy, Madonna, he's done everything. But he went to high school with us as well. And he produced and recorded not produced in the hip-hop sense, but produced as in helped me record and engineer the end of the beginning. And I know him through Jesse, so I wanted both of them to work on it, but I had no idea Ariel was doing as well as he's doing. He did the last Vampire Weekend record as well. Ariel is out of here.
Yeah.
But he's still a cool guy, but I don't think he has time. So, so when Ariel was like, okay, Ariel's not probably going to work, but I would like to work with you and have you produce my record. I said, sure. And about 3 or 4 months after I did the verse for Kosha at his house, I called him and said, are you ready? And that's when he told me about Chandelier. And I was like, fuck, man. Then I was like, do you have time for this shit, or do you want to? And he's like, of course. And you know, like Frank Sinatra, so to speak, I won't give out his business, but you know, we'll call him. And he's like, I have to postpone our date. Can we move it around another day? I'm like, sure, man. You got Frank Sinatra, you got to do it, you know?
Yeah.
But other than that, he focused in on my record, made a lot of time for it, and he didn't sell me out. I was very thankful.
Nice. And, you know, finally, I kind of wanted to wind down by asking about one of your most recent songs that you did with Mr. Len. You recorded My Final Underground Song.
The hard times, man, they come and go, but not the underground dudes like me or one below. And now it's my time to run the show without belt on my brother knife one of those. No shade, everybody needs the sun to grow. And my time underground has been wonderful.
Why are you saying goodbye to the underground?
Oh, man, I think that I've done everything I can do here. And then my underground is, you know, like the people who tell me, oh, I really like the shit you did with Slug. Like, I can go the rest of my life and not hear that. I don't want to hear that anymore. Or I really like when you work with Knife Wonder. Like, I'm over that. That whole person. And for me, with Lynn, it's kind of someone I came into the underground with, and I thought it was a perfect guy. I don't, of course, I didn't charge Lynn for the song, but I don't want to do songs for free for people anymore. I don't want to do songs that nobody's gonna hear anymore. All that shit. Like I'm done rapping for myself. I've done 20 something years of that.
So what's next after the underground, after not doing, you know, trying to move out of that world?
Hopefully I can make pop records. I would love to make some type of mainstream music. I have some type of mainstream career. If not, I'd rather just not do it anymore. I need to see some type of growth. And for me, it's also, it makes room for new people to do underground rap. I feel like people have made a living off underground rap. People say there's room for everybody, but I really don't think there's room here. I really wish some of the people who came up before me would got the fuck out of the way. It kind of made room for other people, but I think that I was underground at making For Real and good music, commercials, and what, I didn't deserve a deal. But I probably should have been signed by somebody to a development deal and like been produced properly and worked with. But no one at that point was taking rap serious. So it took me a while to learn to be a good rapper. But to me, that's what the underground should be for. It should be for raw talent. It shouldn't be people polishing their skills and making a living. Like, you should show some type of growth. Like, to me, if you compare it to sports, which is a bad analogy in some ways, but you should be trying to go pro at some point and letting young people enjoy the underground and develop there and cut their teeth and hone their skill. But, I don't think any less of John Lennon because he sold millions of records. That should be the goal of every artist. Or not, you know? Or not, but to me, if you're gonna, but polishing it, like I was saying, when you brought that up before, like polishing it and making the underground a mini major system is foolish to me. If you're gonna be Ian MacKaye or you're gonna be Bad Brains, to me that's underground. And if you want to do that for the rest of your life, I think a lot of what Sage does is, you know, like a very anti fuck everything type of thing. And you're really gonna wear these boots because they're made in America, and you don't buy anything. And you're living it 100%, go for it. I think there's room for you. But if you are just lazy and want to be half-ass famous, but you don't want to sell out, but you just fucking go mainstream, you know, get your weight up and enter your business, you know, because you're taking away from a young person that needs this area to ready himself to make a decent contribution to the history of music.
Yeah. And last thing, you mentioned Ian MacKaye there. And the last time I saw you in person, we talked about the White Mandingos, your project with Daryl Jennifer and Sasha Jenkins. And we talked about the amazing cover you guys do of Guilty of Being White, of the Minor Threat song.
This song, Guilty of Being White, was originally recorded by Ian MacKaye. And I redid it for my band, White Mandingos. And first, I was very offended when I first heard the song. And then I tried to understand it from Ian's perspective of being a white kid going to school during the late 70s, early 80s, in Chocolate City, D.C., and being probably picked on for the color of your skin, as I was when I went to some white schools when I was younger. And I understand the anger and the angst, and it was an honor to do it, and it's an honor to perform it. And I can see how you could feel like that. I don't understand. I don't feel sorry for you, but it sucks to feel guilty of being white when you are.
Which is amazing, and just, you know, totally flips what has been a very, you know, long problematic song on its head a little bit.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
That was an honor to be able to do that. And that song, you know, it meant a different thing to me 10 years ago than it does now. So it was nice to be able to do it from a place of admiration than from a place of, fuck that guy. Who does he think he is?
And I wanted to ask real quick, like, what you just kind of maybe end on note of, like, what you learned by working with and getting to know Daryl Jennifer.
Daryl Jennifer, mentioned here, is one of the three members, along with Murs and Sasha Jenkins, of the White Mandingos. Jennifer is, of course, more famous as a member of Bad Brains. Bad Brains is an American hardcore punk band formed in Washington, D.C. in 1977. They are widely regarded as among the pioneers of hardcore punk, though the band's members objected to this term to describe their music. The band developed an early reputation in Washington, D.C., due in part to the relative novelty of an entirely black band playing punk rock, but also due to their high-energy performances and undeniable talent. They are also an adept reggae band, while later recordings featured elements of other genres like funk, heavy metal, hip-hop, and soul. Since 1998, the lineup of singer H.R. Human Rights, guitarist Dr. No, bassist Daryl Jennifer, and drummer Earl Hudson, H.R.'s younger brother, has reunited, albeit performing sporadically.
He's part of the sort of ultimate black punk rock group and has dealt with being like, you know, a black musician in a largely white art form for, you know, his whole career, which is analogous to some of the stuff you were talking about a little earlier in your interview.
Man, Daryl was just to break down one specific thing that I learned would be hard. Because it just, you know, there's things I learned from him telling stories. There's things I learned from him watching him record. There's things I learned from him watching him rehearse. There's things I learned from him watching him do press. There's things I've learned from him watching him interact with his, you know, his girlfriend. There's things I learned from him watching him interact with his children. There's things I learned from him watching him interact with his grandchildren. There's things I learned from him sitting at the bar. He's just a fucking, man, he's a jewel, man. He's the last of the Mohicans, like, to keep your sanity, because HR is out of here, you know? Mm-hmm. Earl and Dr. No both have regular jobs. He still, and I don't knock either of them. I don't knock HR for being out of here, and I don't knock Earl and No for being, being a truck driver or working at the health foods or managing a health food store. But for Daryl to, you know, I've learned playing golf. Fucking, he's a great golfer, and his son even better. And they fucking are well-respected members of the country club at Woodstock. Like, it's fucking crazy. To hair maintenance, like, he's probably everything I want to be, and in honor of him, I want to be better so that I could teach the next youth that comes up in our way, which is the same thing for Sasha Jenkins, someone I admire much, because we're all the same type. And I say the same thing for Will.i.am. He's a little different as the success he's had, but there's these individuals that come through Black America, and there's very few of us. So Daryl is everything I am, and I want to be, and hopefully will be, and I can be a little more with his help, because, you know, we still email. I just email him, I love you, I miss you, because I do every day. He's a great dude, and I don't want to wait till he's dead and say what a great guy he is, but, and people don't know the influence that he's had, you know, from the Beastie Boys to Mos Def to Lauryn Hill, and on punk rock as a whole. You know, someone like, I don't know if you know John Joseph from the Cro-Mags, but he's a, you know, kid from foster care who was on drugs, out of his mind, and Bad Brains saved his life. And he went on to be a huge influence in vegan, straight edge, hardcore lifestyle. And he's changed a lot of people's life. So whether someone like the counterculture, super underground, like John Joseph, or someone like the Beastie Boys, like, it's because of Daryl and Bad Brains.
Well, that seems like a great note to end on. Thank you so much for your time and in all our various formats and attempts to talk.
Yeah, we've made it.
We made it to the end. Thank you so much. And I will see you when you come through Irving Plaza. And have a nice life.
Have a nice life. Josh, have a nice life.
All right. Thanks, all right, man. So I didn't expect this interview to get quite as deep and serious as it did quite so quickly, but I'm really glad it did. You know, when I asked the initial question about the song PTSD, I didn't expect a 15-minute discussion on post-traumatic stress and Los Angeles, but I'm so glad it happened. That section was really fascinating, and Murs was completely unsparing in talking about his environment and himself and what he has learned and what he's had to go through to deal with his experiences and the effect that they've had on him. As someone who was, you know, a fan of the underground rap scene of the early aughts, it was fascinating for me to hear what that scene was like for Murs as a performer to navigate. The difficulties he ran into with white performers and with white fans. As far as the performers, you know, what he euphemistically called the cultural differences between him and some of his tour mates, just hearing about that was really eye-opening for me. And as far as the fans, you know, it was good to discuss that while folks may profess to be a fan of an entire scene, often they only support artists who look like them. And hearing Murs' point of view about that and about the ways in which people got defensive when he tried to point that out was really, really interesting. One other thing that was cool about this and that I was happy I was able to do was to go all the way back to 15-year-old Murs on Sunsprayed and, you know, get his memories of being that kid with the backpack and the Loud record shirt and the copy of The Source in his back pocket, you know, just starting to rap and just hooking up with the folks in the Living Legends crew. That's such a vital time creatively and not something that he talks about very much anymore. And I'm glad that we got to talk about Idea, if only so that Josh could throw in his overlong tribute to the rapper. Murs' new record, Have a Nice Life, which is out today, is awesome. Everyone should pick it up. I was very stoked that I was able to listen to it a few weeks early to prepare for this interview. Shouts to Richie over at Juggernaut for the advanced copy. So when I was sitting down with an upcoming guest for a recent interview, he asked me, so what's this show about? What do you try to do? And I said, I try to cover the whole breadth of an artist's career and ask them stuff they haven't been asked before. And I think that we definitely accomplished that with this interview with Murs. Join us next week when we talk to the hilarious rapper, producer, and author, J-Zone. J-Zone carved out a unique comic sensibility and aesthetic on great albums like Music for Tu Madre and the underground classic Pimps Don't Pay Taxes. He's been far more open than most about the struggles of being an underground rapper, and even wrote a book about it called Root for the Villain, Rap, Bullshit, and a Celebration of Failure. His latest album, inspired by some of the essays he wrote in the book, is called Peter Pan Syndrome. You can find The Cypher on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this week's show, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of songs played, at thecyphershow.com. While you're there, check out our archive of over 100 other episodes. And don't forget to visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow to make a donation and to rate, review, and subscribe to The Cypher on iTunes. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
I'll treat their dog like a human being and share peanut butter off the same spoon.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Anger, yeah, that was me.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Just great American music, or just great music in general.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
All right. All right. Is everybody napped up and ready to go?
Yes, I am napped up and ready to go.